You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Bank of America has announced that Mexican immigrants sent home $1 billion less in 2008 than they did in 2007. And the Center for Immigration Studies says that the undocumented immigrant population in the United States declined from 12.5 million to 11.2 million over the same period. What are the consequences for Mexico, a country that's extremely dependent on money sent from abroad, and for the United States, a country that's dependent on Mexican migrant labor? Well, joining me now for today's underreported segment are Sam Quiñones, a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times and the author of Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration from the University of New Mexico Press, and by Dr. Robert Smith, Associate Professor of Sociology, Immigration Studies, and Public Affairs at the Baruch College School of Public Affairs and at the Sociology Department at the Graduate Center of CUNY. He's the author of Mexican New York, Transnational Worlds of New Immigrants, and that's published by the University of California Press. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Robert, how do remittances work?
Remittances are the funds that are sent home by migrants to their families in their country of origin. And there's a study that was done in of the macro impact. What's the larger impact of remittances? And they're about 4 or 5% of gross domestic product in Mexico by themselves. But the multiplier effects of that are much bigger. So because when you send remittances back, people don't just sit on them. They spend them on transportation, food, medicine. So this estimate was that around 15% of the entire gross domestic product of Mexico is generated from remittances. And that's for the whole country. If you actually go down to the street level and the village level, what you end up having is what I call remittance economies, where you've got communities that have been had people migrating for 50, 60 years, sometimes less. But over time, everybody comes to depend on them.
In New York, we have a lot of people from Puebla,
right?
The Mexican city of Puebla. So I'm assuming that Puebla, to some degree, is floated on remittances.
Right. In Puebla is the place where I have done more of my most of my research. And there are towns in Puebla where more than half the population depends for more than 90% of their income on remittances.
Sam, how do Mexicans send remittances back home?
Well, that's changed significantly in the last 10 or 15 years. Used to be there was a lot of it that they would just take it home, when they went home. But in the last, I think since the mid-90s, really, there's been intense competition for remittance sending. It used to be Western Union was the only option. They charged quite a bit of money. Well, people saw there was a profit to be made. Bank of America, a lot of different banks and wire services. You see them in many immigrant communities, as a matter of fact, in the United States, all across Southern California, you can see these things all over. And also major banks like Wells Fargo, Bank of America. Now it's not nearly so expensive to send the money home, which is another reason why the remittances have grown substantially. It's far, far easier, and the knowledge of how to do so is pretty widespread.
But this is also an income source for American banks.
Yes, right, as is a variety of, a lot of immigrants are being illegal or being legal residents but newly legalized, don't have much understanding of banks. They never were marketed to in Mexico as a banking customer. And so banks have found ways of attracting these customers. And, in fact, in parts of Los Angeles where there's heavy immigration, that's where banks are actually doing pretty good business, or have been until recently, I would say.
Robert, how has the economic recession affected the amount and frequency of money immigrants are sending home?
There's been a number of effects. I think it's decreased the amount of money people are sending or the frequency, and it has also deterred some people from coming. There was a lot of talk at the beginning of this downturn that you'd have massive returns of migrants, back to Mexico, and there was a government official that or in office there that in Mexico that estimated 900,000 people would return in the first year. And my conversations with people and my I was in just in Mexico in a month ago in Puebla. I don't see that kind of massive return. What I see is that there has been a deterrent effect because people are telling their relatives and friends, don't come now, the economy is very bad. And I see people sending less money because they're making less. You know, Mexicans in New York, for example, there's a lot of the men in particular are concentrated in the restaurant industry, which is one of the hardest hit industries because it depends so much on discretionary income. So those are some of the effects.
And many work in construction as well.
Yeah.
Is that true in California as well, Sam?
Yes, I would echo what Robert just said. That's I was speaking to I went to a carnival at a little Oaxacan village on Sunday in the San Fernando Valley here in LA, and was asking them precisely that, and they say almost very few people have gone home. The point is that there's, you know, Mexico, the Mexican economy is essentially tied as an appendage almost of the U.S. economy, and whatever is felt here is echoed much strongly more strongly down there. And
recession becomes their recession.
I would say almost depression at times. I mean, the peso's been devalued by 50%. It's the highest unemployment rate since I was reading recently since 1982. Don't quote me on that, but at some long period of time they haven't had this kind of unemployment. The other thing was what you mentioned. Mexicans really facilitated the housing boom that we had over the last let's say 8 or 10 years or so. They were the ones who we employed to improve our houses, put in the flooring, paint the houses, do all the gardening and so on. They came in large numbers, and now they're being unemployed in large numbers, or semi-employed maybe is the better word for a lot of folks, in large numbers because of it. But in California, you do see a few folks, some folks who are rootless here, who don't have the investment, either financial, familial, or emotional investment, do go back. I would not say that's a large number of people, no.
Well, like Robert, you've spent a great amount of time reporting from Mexico. How's the decline in remittances affecting the lives of everyday Mexicans? Do we know how many actually wind up getting remittances? Do either of you know what percentage?
Well, it depends where you are. It depends where you are. In some states, you know, Michoacán, two states in particular that I find very interesting are Michoacán and Zacatecas. They're kind of central and north central states. And really, large parts of those states are simply true appendages of the U.S. economy. I mean, the largest, my understanding is that the largest Zacatecan metro area is really Los Angeles, and Chicago is number two, and number three is the capital of Zacatecas. You know, those states are going to be hammered because so many of those towns depend on, as Robert was saying, depend on this money coming down. There's almost nothing that happens without it. You know, that's the interesting thing about remittances. As a matter of fact, it's actually, I think, a deterrent to real development, to preventing immigration, because you get this money and it's kind of a welfare payment. There's not a lot of incentive to do more with it. And in fact, in the areas where you see the longest periods of migration dating back to the 1940s or the 1950s or 60s, you see almost no jobs created, even though those areas have had huge amounts of dollars poured into them from immigrants. There's no other real option still than migrating for lots of folks, and that's largely because of immigrant remittances. It's they don't help. I don't believe that they really, on balance, overall help economic development in larger areas. They go to developing villages sometimes, but those villages are almost always empty by the time that money is really being felt.
You know, I would I agree in part with what you're saying, Sam. I disagree in part as well. I think the effect of the remittances varies depending on what kind of investment climate there is in the local economy. Because there have been cases documented by studies where when there are ready outlets for investment, people will invest. But I would also but I think in the large part they have not led to a great deal of development. But I would also say that the way that's being framed is that it's remittances are doing it all or nothing. If in fact there was an economic infrastructure and a political infrastructure that could support these people creating jobs, then that capital would have found a use for it.
Well, I throw this out to both of you. How much does the Mexican government depend on remittances as a financial support and even as a safety valve?
Hugely.
Yes, hugely.
So that's
one of the reasons why Mexico, even 8 years after the it's the one reason that Mexico had a one-party state for 71 years, if you ask me. The state probably would have changed long before it had it not had that safety valve. And it's another reason why I think Mexico has been very slow to change. Now that the one-party state does not have the monopoly on power that it did, and there's a kind of a new kind of burgeoning democracy of sorts in Mexico, you would have thought that there would have been far more quick change in the country. One reason I believe it hasn't is because its remittances have kind of made Mexican elites kind of complacent. And the departure of large numbers of poor people, they're not against that either.
I mean, I agree with this analysis. I think you could even go a little further, that the neoliberal policies, right, of the withdrawing state subsidies for a variety of public sectors has gone hand in hand with a narrative that the government has used, promoting migrants as the heroes of Mexico and promoting remittances as the key to development, right? And so at one hand, you've got the state withdrawing where it used to support various popular sectors. And then at the other hand, it's saying, oh, but, you know, it's almost like, don't worry, the migrants are going to send money. So
now,
is
this official Mexican policy? Is this something that's been stated, or is this something that we just understand as reality? Wait, Sam, just for a moment, because I think that I have to tell my audience who I'm talking to again. Sam Quinones of the Los Angeles Times and Robert Smith of Baruch College and also the CUNY Graduate Center. Go ahead, Sam.
Yes, I would say it's more the latter. They can't really officially come out and say, you know, urgently, you know, push people to leave. That would not look good. And there has been a dramatic change, as Robert has said. For a long time, I mean, I kind of thought it as a welcome change, because for so many years, immigrants were brandished as, thought to be traitors to Mother Mexico because they left and they went to the gringo, and how dare they, and what awful people. I mean, over and over, and you saw this all the time, and immigrants feel this still, I think. But with Vicente Fox, he changed the vocabulary and called them VIPs and heroes, as Robert was saying. Mm-hmm. There is a sense, I think, among the Mexican elites, I wouldn't say necessarily just the government, but a lot of folks, that, you know, what's the real problem if poor people leave, you know? And what's they send this money back, and isn't that a good thing, and they're gone, and they're not causing problems here, or they're not, you know, being a burden here. So there is this kind of tacit idea that, well, it's not the worst thing.
No, and I think that in certain circles you'll hear very open conversation. What Sam is saying, you'll hear very openly, but you won't hear government officials saying it. But what's interesting as well is that what we've had emerge over the last 15 years has been a sort of transnational political arena where migrants have now organized themselves in the United States and had very important impacts on politics, including electoral politics in Mexico. And they're challenging that rhetoric and saying, we wouldn't have had to migrate if it wasn't for you guys being corrupt. And this led to, among other things, they got the right to vote in the 2006 election, although it was in a very constrained and limited way. But it's a very interesting dynamic that's emerged, where the people who have left the country are now courted as a very important constituency, because the political class cannot afford to be anti-migrant, even if they're not doing all the things that they might do to stop that migration.
Now, how is Mexico's president, Felipe Calderón, reacting to the U.S. economic crisis? Has he made any public statements about it? Because as you both point out, the U.S. economy is the or one of the key factors in Mexico's economy.
Honestly, if you, I really haven't paid any attention to what he said about the economy because he's been so busy with his drug war that I mean, it seems to me that that's taken up a lot of his time. I'm sure he's made statements about it, but right now, I mean, the two are kind of related in a sense, but right now the drug war with the cartels is savage and unprecedentedly savage violence.
Well, we have to take a little break and we'll come back to those drug wars and their impact on this story. My guests are Sam Quinones, staff writer at the Los Angeles Times. His book, Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration, published by the University of New Mexico Press. Also, Dr. Robert Smith, Associate Professor of Sociology, Immigration Studies, and Public Affairs at the Baruch College School of Public Affairs and at the Sociology Department at the Graduate Center at CUNY. He has written a book called Mexican New York, Transnational Worlds of New Immigrants, and it's published by the University of California Press. Stay with us. We're back with Underreported, a look at Mexico and the impact of the U.S. economic crisis on Mexico. My guests are Dr. Robert Smith, Associate Professor of Sociology, Immigration Studies, and Public Affairs at the Baruch College School of Public Affairs and at the Sociology Department at the Graduate Center of CUNY, and Sam Quinones, a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times. And we were talking circling around the drug war in Mexico. The U.S. Joint Forces Command has recommended that Mexico be listed next to Pakistan as a weak and failing state. Do either of you agree with that, or do both of you agree with that? Robert?
I think a weak or failing state is a I think that's precipitous. I do think, however, that that the situation is quite serious and is spreading to places where it had not been before, and it has infiltrated into the army, certainly the police. I mean, what happened first, it was infiltrating into the police and local officials, and then they brought the army in. Now it's infiltrated there. Now Calderon has really taken the traffickers on and has had sort of, you know, special forces on it. And I think one of the things that the U.S. needs to do, and I've been delighted to see the coverage in the Times lately, is to look at how the two countries are independent this way, right? The old way, you know, one of the ways, obviously, is that the drugs that are being brought in are being consumed by us, so we're creating this instability south of our border. But the other thing is this, you know, the gun sales. I mean, these reports in the Times lately that Mexican officials estimate 80% to 90% of the guns used by the traffickers in Mexico are sold in the United States. I think this is a thing that needs to be talked about when we talk about whether or not assault rifles are protected under the, you know, by the Constitution, whether the state does, the U.S. state has a compelling interest in limiting these sales so it doesn't destabilize our southern neighbor.
So, Sam, if Mexico isn't on its way to becoming a failed state, is narco state more accurate? That's how the former U.S. drug czar Barry McCaffrey recently characterized Mexico.
A narco state, I guess I'd have to know what the definition of that is. Some areas have been, you know, influenced, let's say, by narcotics traffickers for a long time. The state of Sinaloa, of course, springs to mind. On the other hand, you know, there's an ample amount of evidence that a lot of the drug trafficking that took place for many years, beginning in the 60s, was essentially controlled by members of the Mexican government, particularly certain parts of the law enforcement in the Mexican government. So there's always been that influence. I guess I just have to know what he means by that. Do the narcos control vast regions the way, say, in Colombia, the guerrilla movements down there? No, they don't. You know, and I would agree with Robert that I think it's premature or not quite there yet to say, oh, a failed state. You know, I think you can go around lots of parts of Mexico and not see any problems, you know. But that doesn't mean that we should just kind of blithely sit around and say, oh, well, there's no problem. It is a very serious thing. It doesn't need to be as bad as, say, Afghanistan, for it to be really bad.
And well, you wrote
a lot of attention.
You wrote an article called State of War for the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine.
Right.
So you're saying Mexico is in a state of war.
I would say there's a war. In fact, there's two or three wars going on, what's happening, really. There's a war with the government for the first time in the history of the drug trafficking industry in Mexico, actively and relentlessly taking on the traffickers, which is a major new thing down there, and Americans ought to really stand up and recognize how new that is. But also, among the trafficking organizations themselves, they're also warring because, with a long explanation for why that all is, but they're warring over certain routes into the United. That's always what they're warring about, really. But the war has really kind of mounted to unprecedented levels. And Juarez has lately, of course, been the main area, but Nogales is also one. Tijuana, for a long time last year, was a site of very, very bloody and just utterly barbaric things. You know,
but should anybody be upset that criminals are killing criminals?
Oh, of course. No. That's an entirely wrong way to look at it. Look at the state of Sinaloa. Sinaloa is where drug trafficking started, and the legitimate society in Sinaloa had that very attitude. Don't worry, it's just a bunch of Yahoo hayseeds up in the hills selling their dope to the gringo, and you know the gringo has to have his dope, so why do we care? We don't care at all. And they let these guys grow and fester and mature and get more sophisticated until they're now this kind of hydra-headed beast that it takes almost every resource the government has to defeat. And that is what's in store if we as two countries together decide that, well, it's not really that bad an idea if they're just killing each other. Plus, you know, lots of innocent people are getting in the way. That's another new part of all this. It used to be that in these narco wars, that it would only be narcos who would die, and that is definitely not the case anymore.
And 5,000 killed last year, 2,500 the year before.
And it's on pace to go higher than that this year. I don't remember what the figures were, but the bloodiest day of the Calderon administration was a couple Wednesdays ago.
And there's a couple other things I'd like to say. I think that the President Calderon deserves a tremendous amount of respect and should get help from Washington, because he has really gone after these guys in a way that I've never seen before, and it's been very gutsy. I think an ironic way that that links up this trafficking with migration is that in many of these cases, the migrant belt, the state has basically been defunded by this neoliberal strategy, and so one of the things that happens is that the narcos have a lot of money, so they pay for the town's feast, or they pay for, you know, school kids' books or whatever, and they gain legitimacy because they're like public philanthropists. Another thing is that when you get this kind of violence, I mean, you know, Sam was talking before about places like Zacatecas, which is basically the entire state is basically a nursing home and a nursery for migrants, right? There's almost no working age men except in the capital city. But imagine what will happen to these regions or other regions like them when you get this kind of violence spreading. And there's another thing that has happened as well. It used to take 15, 20 years for migration to go from being a few people to being everybody in the village. There's now a phenomenon that a scholar in Mexico has identified as accelerated migration, where it's happening in 6 or 7 years. And this is before the narco traffics.
But I wonder about the whole matter of so many being killed due to Calderon's initiative. Doesn't that suggest it's not working?
No. I have to disagree. That look, this was a cancer. This is a festering sore. There is, I mean, it's a horrifying thing what's happening in Mexico, but in order to attack it, I just don't see how you were going to attack it and not have lots of deaths. It's been allowed to fester for so long and grow so sophisticated and so well-funded and so well-armed and entrenched in all the different parts of particularly along the border, it just wasn't going to happen otherwise. To say it's a good, I'm not saying it's a good thing, I want to be understood on that point, but it definitely was, it's I don't see how you could take on these groups in a mature, responsible way, the way any mature and responsible government would do so, and not expect lots and lots of death.
Didn't the government kind of bring this upon itself, Robert, because it didn't pay the police very well, and it almost invited the kind of corruption that we've seen?
I think there's been a culture of corruption in public office there for many years, and then you have a one party that's in power for 71 years that also promotes corruption. But I think in a certain sense you've had a kind of a perfect storm of elements that have come together here, where you've had prolonged financial crisis, you've had selling off of state enterprises, you've had a free enterprise system that's generated lots of wealth, and then and consistently high demand for these for drugs, and so yes, I think that it's not a, and I don't think that most people who know about this in Mexico wouldn't disagree that in fact this is in large part the house that the government has built. They're now trying to take it down and reassemble it.
Is it likely to this violence put more pressure on the Mexican economy because tourism is going to suffer?
Yes, I think, and not only the drug trafficking, but the general the perception of insecurity in Mexico. Mexico surpassed Colombia a couple of years ago as the kidnap capital in Latin America. I don't know this the last year what this,
are they kidnapping tourists?
They're not kidnapping tourists, but they're kidnapping lots of people. I mean, not as a rule, but if you're going to a place where lots of people are getting kidnapped, you can pick a vacation spot where, it's a very kidnap-sensitive industry, is my thinking about tourism.
Now, Sam Ruben Beltran, the Consul General of Mexico in New York, was on the Brian Lehrer Show last month, and he said the violence is highly concentrated in four counties, and that Mexico is a very solid state.
Yeah, I mean, that's also true. The other problem is that those counties shift. I mean, since this war began by my counting, really began in 2005, there have been major fronts in Nuevo Laredo, Acapulco, Michoacán, Sinaloa, Juarez, Nogales, Tijuana, and maybe some other places that Monterrey. So it keeps on shifting, Mazatlan a little bit. Anyway, it keeps on shifting. One other thing I'd like to add to what y'all were just mentioning there, Robert was just mentioning, one of the things you see most clearly in this war is the problem that Mexico faces with weak city government. I mean, it's very clear. You see, look at Juarez, where there's been hundreds and hundreds of, there's a war going on. And mm-hmm. El Paso has the lowest crime rate in the United of a big city in the United States.
And just a line, an imaginary line, separates the two places.
Except for that, it is imaginary in one sense, but it's very real in another. In one side, you have a city government and essentially a law enforcement structure, court structure, et cetera. The whole thing, everything goes along with city and state government that is very weak and very riddled with not just corruption, but incompetence, and is underfunded, and a variety of problems. We could go into a long, long list of problems. On the other side, you have really the opposite. Even though El Paso is not anywhere near the wealthiest town in America, it's still got a very strong city government, very well-trained cops, well-paid cops, a good police force. What this war is showing is how important local government is, because Mexican government in Mexico City looks out across the vast panorama of its country, looking for allies, the kind of allies that normally would be fighting this war first. That is to say, local cops, local task forces of sheriffs and state police and local police officers, and they have none of that, and so they have to use the army. And that is the great problem, that the reforms they haven't made are now coming back to haunt them.
You know, I have an anecdote that reflects this. In one of the places I've done research for about 20 years, I was down there a month ago, and one of the local mayors had called the federal authorities because he found a marijuana field, and he got death threats for this. And his police force is about 10 guys with shotguns. These local mayors were instructed, don't move in if you see a safe house or anything. Call the federal guys. Just back off. It's a complete mismatch.
Now, Robert, yeah. The three former presidents of Latin American countries, Brazil, Colombia, and Mexico, just released a report calling for a change in U.S. strategy in the war on drugs, even suggesting the decriminalization of drugs. Would legalizing drugs solve the problem?
Oh, I don't know if it would solve the problem. I think... And I'm not sure that decriminalizing drugs would ever happen in the United States. I think that I'd probably give you an Obama answer on this one and say, let's focus on the things that we can agree about, like trying to eliminate the flow of AK-47s to Mexico from Arizona, for example. And let's work very closely with Calderon to make sure we're doing everything we can, and let's decrease demand here. That would probably be my... I would punt the first question and then suggest.
Sam, are you punting too?
Well, actually, I'm as a reporter, I'm kind of constrained. But let me say this about a legalization. Marijuana is often presented as the gateway drug, meaning that people use it and then they go on to other drugs and so on. It is also, however, because it's illegal, it's also a gateway drug for traffickers in the following sense. Traffickers, when they start out as just a young kid, you know, looking to get into the business, they don't have any connections with Colombia. They don't have any capital to be able to buy Colombian cocaine or even precursor chemicals to make methamphetamine or any of that. Normally, what the way traffickers start is by a few pounds of marijuana, maybe a couple kilos or what have you, in a suitcase or some small amount of dope, taking it north. That way they develop their confidence, their networks, their routes, their clients, and their capital. And so most traffickers, I think, anyway, in Mexico, I'm talking about Mexico now, primarily in Sinaloa, Durango, Chihuahua, all those areas in northwest Mexico and so on, start by selling marijuana. Because it's illegal, it is their startup capital. They can't go to a bank for a loan, so they get a few kilos of marijuana, take it north, and that's how they get started. And from then on, they have the capital, and eventually they get into other more serious drugs. So marijuana is not just a gateway drug for users, which it may well be, but it's also one the way traffickers get started in Mexico.
My guests are Sam Quinones, a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times, and Robert Smith, associate professor of sociology, immigration studies, and public affairs at Baruch College School of Public Affairs, and also in the sociology department at the Graduate Center of CUNY. This is WNYC. The president has on his website a statement that he feels that raids of factories and the like for looking for immigrants are ineffective and puts the burden of a broken system on immigrant families. And yet there was a large immigration raid just this past Tuesday in a Washington State factory, 28 people arrested. Our newsroom wants to know what's going on. Do you have any sense of whether the president will continue these kinds of raids?
He didn't call me to ask me what. But
no, I understand you can't. You,
nor
you
did
don't
he call
have.
Me.
Yeah, I know both of you don't have a hotline to the president, but isn't that
but
a mixed message?
But if he wants
message?
To call, I'll give you my cell phone number. I have.
Well, what do you think about those raids?
I doubt this is the leading edge of his policy. I think we haven't heard anything on immigration from him so far or during the campaign because of the financial meltdown. But I think it would be politically impossible to say you can't do any more raids. However, there are a lot of things that we can do that we should do as a civilized society to try to address this problem. We now have 2 to 3 million undocumented children in this country and about 12 million undocumented grown-ups. And these people have many of these kids. For example, I'm working with a case now of a kid who's been here since he was 3 years old. He's 25. He's being deported. He doesn't have criminal record or anything like this. And it makes no sense. It's sort of like, a lot of these kids speak Spanish very badly. They've grown up here speaking English. And in a sense, it's almost like the United States is conducting a very cruel natural experiment on these undocumented children. What it's basically saying is, all right, you guys, you came in when you were 3 years old. We're going to let you go to school here until in free public education till age, till 12th grade. And then we're going to tell you that you're not, you can't participate in any of the major institutions, the labor market, many places you can't go to college. And then we're going to see, okay, now what happens to you? And it seems to me that this country is better than that, that this seems to be a cruel, a very mean season on immigration, a very cruel way to treat a very vulnerable population.
Sam, aren't you seeing that on in the Southwest as well, and not just with Mexican immigrants, but immigrants from all over Central America?
My impression is that there's increased rates, clearly since the 2007 breakdown of that debate over immigration reform, Homeland Security decided that they were just going to start raiding. One of the problems, I understand exactly what Robert's saying, and I find myself being tugged both ways often. The problem with any immigration reform that you may want to have is that it has been blocked so far by people who really believe that the rule of law is being corroded and flouted and in many cases destroyed by this kind of widespread ignoring of illegal immigrants in the United States. And they were able to block that. That's why we don't have immigration reform. So I think it would be very difficult, again, for the Obama administration to say, okay, we're going to go back to the Bush years when there was no enforcement of labor law.
But
where that leaves us, I'm not sure, and it's a kind of issue where there are times when I just prefer not to get into it. But it's not an easy one, and there is another constituency out there that actually has very little power in the halls of Congress, the way I understand it, but yet is able to bring about a tie, a kind of a gridlock in this thing, because they believe that because they honestly believe that that this is the flouting of the rule of law that's very unhealthy for the country.
And I have to leave it there. I want to thank you both so much for being with us, Sam Quiñones. His book, Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration, published by the University of New Mexico Press. Robert Smith, his book, Mexican New York, Transnational Worlds of New Immigrants, published by the University of California Press. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.